Welcome to QualityCast North, a podcast dedicated to showcasing healthcare quality improvement across Northern British Columbia. Our podcast is sponsored by the Physician Quality Improvement Initiative, or PQI. PQI is a flagship program of the Specialist Services Committee, which is a collaboration between the Provincial Ministry of Health and the Doctors of BC, with representation from local health authorities. We are casting to you today from the traditional territory of the Kladlay-Tené First Nation. And hosting today's episode are Dr. Sheer Chewy and myself, Deanna Danskin.
On today's episode, we're talking about delivery of Indigenous health. Making up just 6% of the total population in BC, those who identify as Indigenous, either First Nations, Métis or Inuit, represent almost 20% of our population in Northern BC. And when it comes to the provision of healthcare, their cultural, historical, and geographical differences, Indigenous people and populations can pose specific challenges to our healthcare system, which require different skill sets, approaches, and mindsets from its providers. Here today to talk about their experiences providing care for Indigenous people are today's two guests. Dr. Todd Alec, a family physician practicing with Karyasakani Family Services, located on the traditional territories of the Kladlay-Tené, which is colonially known as Prince George, and Dr. Shiona Mitchell-Foster, an obstetrician and gynecologist also based on unceded Kladlay-Tené territory. Drs. Alec and Mitchell-Foster are the collaborative medical leads for Indigenous Health with Northern Health, and we'll be learning more about the subject from them today. Welcome to the show, both of you, and thank you for joining us. Now, to start us off, I'm hoping you can give us a little background about yourselves. And so can I ask you a little bit about your journeys into medicine to the point in your career where you are now?
You bet. Yeah, no, it's great to be part of the podcast. So as far as my background, I'm a first generation Peruvian. And on my maternal side, I'm fifth generation white settler from Treaty 6 territory in the Alexander and Paul First Nation, which is known as Northern Alberta. And on my dad's side, Scottish. I grew up mostly in Latin America, a bit in Scotland, and then moved to Canada during high school. And so my upbringing was in many, I suppose it was very peripatetic. And I was exposed to a lot of different cultures, and it was certainly quite the shock to move to Canada, especially to Alberta, the prairies. That was a winter I will never forget my first winter. But I think my journey towards medicine was very much connected to my interest in global health and in really diverse populations, and in the inherent disparities that we see in access to wealth and health and all of those things. And in many ways, I think that's certainly what led me to focus on obstetrics and gynecology, is these massive disparities that we see when it comes to women's health in global settings, and certainly in Canada as well, where there's very significant gaps when it comes to pregnant people's health. And I expect that that's a big part of why I became interested in working with Indigenous folks in Canadian settings as well. So yeah, that's a bit about my what led me to medicine.
What about you, Todd?
Kladlay-Tené Snatcher at the end notice Cian Jan Noyan Kadasa Tadal Klasusi Nakasi Hasa Dakasihamnus Dakasihasia Samasuasto. So Todd Alec, family doctor, like you were saying. So just knowledge of traditional territory. Actually, I'm kind of living in Tacla and still have our place in Prince George, because we do a little bit of both and we're trying to spend a little more time out and back to the traditional territory of my wife's right now. For me, it was a little bit unconventional. My parents both had a degree in accounting and forestry. So we were pretty relatively new in the academic kind of field. Like, you know, if you historically, you know, there wasn't allowed to do too much education, you know, like, and actually my father actually was in the day school, you know, in the 90s, which is kind of odd to have, you know, to have that connection still. So you know, just was always good at the sciences and just said, hey, you know, let's try to shoot for the stars and become a doctor. And so I thought that would be kind of a plan. And so no real rhyme or reason or anything. It was just that kind of background. And actually, you know, two of the big successes that I would say that kind of got me interested in medicine was we have two nurses from NECASI, which where I'm from. And they went away, did their schooling, and then came back and were RNs in our community, and worked as community clinicians for many years. And you just seen the wonderful work that Renata and Lisa both did back at home in NECASI when I was growing up. And so I thought I would try to do something in healthcare and, you know, the generic help out some people and just kind of go through that route and, you know, never knowing what yourself getting into, you know, and was just very fortunate to be, you know, doing well in the sciences. And then even just a little bit of guidance, like thinking about my uncle Dean, who did some post-secondary, you know, I was thinking of taking these courses to get ready. He's like, oh, you better do your physics and all that stuff and play that game. Cause it is a bit of a process and hurdle to get to this point. Currently been part of the medical admissions committee for the medical school for the last 5 years and just really seeing all the incredible applicants and just happy to be here to be able to keep doing this work. And that's how it kind of happened. And yeah, then we're here and really fortunate to be working with a lot of Indigenous people.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing your stories. You're right. Everyone has a different story, right? Everyone has their own path to get here. And we've been really privileged actually to hear so many different stories about the guests who come on this show and their journeys to medicine. And so I wonder if I could ask you, in addition, to tell us a little bit about your current practices at work and the teams you work with. Shona, can we start with you?
Well, I get to work with the most excellent Todd Alec, as well as Nicole Cross, as in a co-leadership team with the Indigenous Health team for Northern Health. And that's really just been since kind of April, May, that we've started that position. And for me, that's a really exciting team to be part of. There's been a lot of change within the Indigenous Health team in Northern Health over the past year. And to be part of that team is incredibly motivating. A really kind of hopeful team that is doing very challenging work. And you kind of have the idea that I can do hard things as long as I'm not alone.
What about you, Todd? What does your team look like?
So the same role, you know, with one of the co-leads in the Indigenous Health team for Northern Health. So that's been a great opportunity to work with Shona and the team, and just such a wonderful team. Main job that I've been doing for the last 5 years is working with Karasikani Family Services, and I do some outreach to Yakuche and Takla, where I go into community, and we have a blended model where we do some virtual telehealth support, but we actually have about 11 communities. So we actually do some telehealth support for all the communities, and we kind of share that virtual kind of space to try to provide access, as well as go to the Kleitlitane, the reserve. They have a health clinic there, and work on the First Nation Health Authority virtual doctor of the day, which started after the pandemic. So we provide virtual support mainly in the region. So I work in the northern region where we provide telephone visits or Zoom visits to provide primary care for Indigenous people up in the north as a result of the pandemic and having difficulty accessing primary care providers during the pandemic, as well do some work with the Royal Coordination Center of BC we were talking about earlier, work on the RISE group, which is the Inclusion, Social Justice and Equity team. So we're implementing the TRC calls to action in the organization. That does some advocacy for rural physicians trying to provide better care in rural settings. And they got me included in the UBC medical admissions process. So I've been part of that various committees for the last 5 years.
Wow. So yeah, both of you are incredibly busy and have a lot of different hats there. That's great. It sounds like we've got the right people for this particular subject on the podcast today.
I'm wondering now if we could talk about the practice of medicine and how it sort of differs for Indigenous people versus what we traditionally do for the predominantly white settler population. So how is the practice of medicine for Indigenous people different from the practice for the white settler populations? And I think more specifically, the conventional way that medicine is taught from the medical school right at the beginning, if you have any kind of comments on that.
When an Indigenous person presents it for emergency care versus a settler, they get very disparate care. I think the key parts in improving that care is there's a whole lot of self-reflection that has to happen on behalf of clinicians in understanding the role that we're playing within that system, and kind of this how we're trained and we're just marinated within this system, and so much of it becomes very integrated into how we provide care. And so I think that's a critical step of things where we really have to acknowledge the harm to be able to move forward. I think one of the really exciting areas that the Northern Health team is working on is specifically looking at the Indigenous patient experience, and what that turns into is the patient quality care and the complaints process. And how can we make that not only more transparent, but actually transform it into something that is, it's not punitive, it does not involve, you know, medical legal components, but it's actually restorative and actually focused on improving care.
Even small steps to improve cultural safety, how can that improve health outcomes for our Indigenous patients?
I'll let Todd lead here.
Yeah, maybe start, if, you know, particularly previous experiences, you know, that's going to really dictate, you know, if people go in. You know, we get a lot of phone calls about, you know, and especially a virtual service where they have some issues, you know, with some chest pain or some type of emergent thing that actually can't be done very well on the phone or even through Zoom and needs to have an assessment in the emergency department. And a lot of times we find with patients need to just get that reassurance to be like, yes, you know, I think you need to go there. And, you know, because, you know, one, it does, you know, you know, you're going to probably wait, you know, 5 hours or more to be assessed. And sometimes you get things fine and sometimes you don't, but you need to kind of validate their concerns and kind of encourage so they don't miss anything. Two, though, is that they might have had a bad experience there where they kind of vowed that they're never going to go back. And so if it was just with some of the staff or the physician might have made a comment or they've seen something gone bad with another relative that they just don't feel like, you know, they're going to get any good care. So, unfortunately, that's the reality that some people don't want to go in. And so we really have to kind of work on that to try to help them. And if that's by calling the emergency and giving them heads up that this patient's coming so that we can kind of tell them their concern to help facilitate that, or even just give them that reassurance that we're there to help support, it's been a kind of some of the work that I've seen in the last number of years. And now the question is how do we help improve that? And, you know, this Indigenous health team has been a great kind of way to kind of look at that and see how we can do that. Because, you know, unfortunately we do have people who are so reluctant until they're on their death doors, or even not after that won't go in, that have some readily, easily preventable things that could be dealt with by going to the emergency department and getting tested and treated. But there is a bit of a reluctance to do that at times. So, you know, that's a difficult question to answer of how we're going to do that. But, you know, we're looking at doing some cultural sensitivity training, you know, and try to really promote that within our healthcare staff, trying to work with the Indigenous patient experience team to do those reviews of any wrongdoings, but also to look at some of the recommendations so that we can learn from the future. You know, we had a case before there's patient was quite agitated, was having some issues. So, you know, sometimes we have to use some measures through chemical or physical restraints if there's any kind of safety concerns, and we have to do this, you know, for the wellness of the patient. Subsequent the family was involved and there was a complaint, and as a result they did a review and they said, you know, we were safe, we did everything, this person, you know, we look at a safety perspective from only the patient, that this patient was safe and didn't die, and we got all this stuff and we didn't do any wrong, like this is great. And then from one part of the review was that well, actually, some communication with the family would have been better, because I think it was pretty traumatizing to see some of the stuff that were done and not really communicated as effectively as can. And you know, be cognizant that, you know, during those stressful times, you know, we could work on our communication, but there are some findings that we can find from that experience and from that team to see how we can better ourselves and include myself, you know. And I would love to be, you know, a fly on a wall to John Baptiste and their team's work, because they do some incredible work and we could do some findings and trying to find a ways how to disperse that to our team and even provincially.
Thank you for that. Yeah, that's great. I wonder if we could just expand a little bit more on that and talk about some of the other challenges that the Indigenous patients face when they're accessing healthcare. You've mentioned about the racism and about some of the issues with the communication, but are there any other challenges that Indigenous patients face when they access healthcare that maybe physicians are unaware of, for example? And do you have any live examples about how medicine as conventionally practiced really does miss the mark when it comes to Indigenous peoples?
So trying to access even basic things such as blood work or CTs or any imaging or investigations are a lot more difficult. Even getting a prescription, you know, in a relatively quick manner is difficult. Some of them, you got to fly it in or go through a boat or drive on a 3-hour dirt road to get there. So there's always sometimes of a delay. So, you know, when we, you know, if you're working at VGH and you have all these, you know, investigations and things at your disposal, you don't have that when you're working with an Indigenous person living in Seke or Takla. And so you have to kind of use what you have and try to find some innovative ways to kind of work with the patient and then, you know, trying to do stuff. So for instance, even say some of our colleagues in Fort St. James found that there was issues of trying to get people, and they've had actually, you know, some mortalities in the past where people are driving an hour and a half to go to Prince George to get a pulmonary function test to do a lung test. And they said, well, we can actually do that back home. So we're trying to find some innovative ways to lessen that kind of travel burden so they can have stuff in community as best we can. And if that means getting specialists out there or some investigations, such as like some echocardiograms from some family doctors that can do some bedside point of care ones to start as a screen, and trying to bring the healthcare to the community members to lessen that burden. You know, I always use the story when during COVID, I was living up in Takla and we always walk with the kids, and I just tripped on a rock and I probably broke my foot and probably my, at that time there was a lot of restrictions. So if I went to go get an x-ray, I would have probably had to self-isolate for about 2 weeks, but also I had to drive 3 hours on a dirt road and then 3 hours on a dirt road back to tell me to use a hard sole boot. And I actually had that awareness that there probably wasn't going to be much done, but that's a lot of logistics just to, you know, get a basic x-ray. Whereas if you're living in a bigger center, it's not as big of a deal. So, you know, you really feel for our patients, of trying to figure out how to get all these investigations is a big process. And so I feel like a lot of our work is just trying to figure out that logistics aspect of how to help support them get that. And, you know, in particular, in an environment like such in the North, you know, we're talking to the surgery team, and the wait times to see an orthopedic surgeon up in the North is substantially higher. You know, it's 18 months plus to see them, and there's big wait times for surgeries, and that's like another year compared to other health authorities such as like Vancouver Coastal. And from the traveler perspective, for First Nations to have some travel that's available to help out, it's like 24 cents a kilometer, even if it's on a dirt road. And they'll only go to Prince George, the closest center, and they won't allow you to travel down to Vancouver. So we're working on trying to do some metrics to try to get similar kind of care or readily accessible care for people and really trying to work on that logistical aspect. And that's what I see anyways. But I'd love to hear what Dr. Mitchell Foster wants.
From a reproductive care perspective, I think there's things that come up again and again, and I'm reminded of work when I do clinics at Central Ontario Native Health Society. I'm part of a multidisciplinary team, which is an amazing way to practice. And I remember seeing, you know, a young woman, and there's a lot of different conditions in obstetrics and gynecology where there's some type of hormonal treatment that's recommended. And often this is something that also acts as a contraceptive to prevent pregnancy. And I remember sitting with someone and going over the whole history and everything. And I thought that I had just been the most culturally safe and sensitive physician of all time in connecting with this young woman. You know, we understood each other, and we had a plan. I was going to follow up, and she left the clinic. And about an hour later, there was a knock on my door, and it was one of the counselors who said, "Oh, Shona, could I just chat with you about this patient?" And came back in, and she had left my office after nodding and smiling and be like, "Yes, Dr. Fisher, yes, Dr. Fisher Foster, yes, Dr. Fisher Foster," and had gone and cried in his office about being given treatment that would mean she could never get pregnant. And this was just complete, you know, she had premature ovarian insufficiency and it required hormones for her cardiac health, for her bone health. And that aspect of things, I was completely unaware of. And for me to pause, and obviously in gratitude to my colleague, where I get to be part of this team who could actually educate me on this, grateful that the patient felt comfortable going and explaining that and seeking care. And then thinking about how I could actually improve the care I was given. Because if you're giving a medication, even if it's for cardiac and bone health, that it also acts as a contraception for someone whose, you know, aunties have been forcibly sterilized, it is a completely different discussion. And thinking about, you know, obviously intergenerational trauma, but these very specific stories that she's aware of what that means for her future and how much harm I did in that discussion. And so these are examples of ways where we certainly in no way mean to do harm and to create this kind of, you know, tiered treatment levels. But that's what it translates into. And I think about that in across the spectrum of reproductive care, reproductive screening. One of my areas of expertise is in cervical cancer screening. And in British Columbia, invasive cervical cancer, if you're First Nations, your chance of having invasive cervical cancer is like 95% higher than if you're non-First Nations. That's not because of any genetic risks at all. It's much more related to the lack of culturally safe places where people can access care and access screening. And so these are, you know, knowing the specific history that we work within, but also the individual trauma, the issues of access around rural and remote communities, like Dr. Alec was talking about, we really desperately have to look at things from an intersectional perspective. And, you know, that includes these intersections of like race, poverty, gender, rurality, all of these really add up to a very different story when we're looking at deconstructing these systems and how they do harm.
And so it's quite clear from the conversations we've been having today that physicians as a group probably have a bit of catching up to do when it comes to supporting Indigenous patients. And this sounds like it's going to be a career-long commitment on their part if they want to improve. I wonder whether you can give us any practical tips as physicians for that you might suggest to us for improving the quality of care that we provide to Indigenous patients and start making things more culturally safe. Can we start with you, Todd?
Yeah, you know, funny story. So when I got out of residency, you know, you're an Indigenous person. I'm Dakath carrier from the area, so I'm going out to Yakuche, which is you know, like traditionally, it's about an hour drive from where I'm from for community. So say, I'm going to go there. I'm going to provide this good culturally safe care. Everything's going to go well. And my colleague who's been going there for about 10, 12 years before, And so you get there and then no one shows up, you know, there's like two or three people, you know, the first couple of trips. And I'm like, what's going on here? You know, like, you know, I'm trying to do my best and no one showed up. And you know, it took some time, you know, to really build that relationship. And so it wasn't even the care, it just, you know, you know, we got to start seeing people and start dealing with the problems. But I think that, you know, continue on onboarding. So, you know, particularly in this world where we're doing a lot of virtual safers, I think you need to be in person, you know, you need to at a minimum have some in-person presence and some virtual to really build that relationship. But I think it's just time and continual visits and to hear from where their background is and to understand what their kind of concerns are or things that they don't want to do and really just trying to see where they're at and work with them. So I promise you over time, it did get a lot more busy, but you know, you're thinking about all these things that we're trying to do. And I think it's just relationship building. And I think there's a lot of rules for a lot of things we can do. So I think we should, you know, personally look at some different cultural sensitivity training so we can get a little more context. But also I think we should put some onus on ourselves to do some relationship building, not only with the patients, but also with the community to kind of get a better understanding. So we've seen some neat events where Anton Meyer, when he was one of the Fort St. James physicians, had a couple day event where they just did some knowledge translation with the NECSLE team and had some time to really have some food together and see each other in community gatherings and really trying to build that relationship because, you know, we do some great cultural sensitivity work, but I think there's a role for some on the ground community work, but also some just traditional, some learning of all the things, you know, because, you know, we have a lot of physicians that come from all over the world that recruited up in the north. And so they might not necessarily know what residential school is or the 60 scoop or the traditional people from this area and how they differ from, you know, even a couple hundred kilometers away, you know. Ray Markham would say, you know, he has this famous word. He says, when you go to one rural community, you've gone to one rural community because they're not the same, you know, and there's just different dynamics and cultures and people and really have to try to have an understanding of some of their issues they face in particular in the community and how you can help support them to deal with whatever kind of healthcare needs that they need. So,
and from you, Shanna, any suggestions or tips?
I think one of the really exciting things about providing kind of culturally safe care and trauma-informed care as well is a lot of it is that it doesn't just improve care for Indigenous folks. It actually improves care for everyone. The, you know, asking for consent before we do an examination, like, that's good for everyone, you know, for anyone who's experienced trauma, but also for just anyone in general to know that their voice matters, that their body is going to be respected. This is really important, important work. And I'm always reminded by Dr. Jesse King, who's a friend and colleague, a prof at UNBC, who's First Nations. And she talks about the, you know, the improvement in cell coverage along the Highway of Tears and how this is like so critically important for the safety of Indigenous women and girls to have more communication, more transportation. And she says, and it's important and it improves things for everyone. So for the truckers, for anyone who's driving through there in the winter. And I think that that's a, you know, that's an example that readily transfers to healthcare in that when we are pausing to connect first with our patients, to see them and to hear them and to really develop those skills of connecting first and then going into the medical history and medical treatment, that benefits everyone. And I think that is a really kind of powerful lesson that we learn from doing, you know, learning more about you know, culturally safe care specifically as it relates to our Indigenous populations in BC and in the setting we work in Northern Health. And I think like the first step for physicians and certainly was for me is just the willingness to be uncomfortable, the willingness to understand that we work within an incredibly flawed system. It doesn't mean that you know, we are intentionally doing harm in any way. But this is the system that we work within, and we have a responsibility really to be open, to be vulnerable, and to be humble. And I think starting from those steps, that's kind of what sets us up for providing good, safe care to Indigenous folks or anyone who's coming in scared and traumatized to the emergency department.
Oh, thank you for that. And that's oh yeah, Todd, do you want something to add?
Yeah, and then there's just that also personal aspect too, you know. So like when a patient, you know, you see them at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, we're all tired and, you know, and a little bit grumpy and don't really have that reserve, you know. So I think, you know, those are some of the times where we do have some bad care where we're a little bit short with people. And so, you know, we're in this big age of a lot of burnout, you know, from, you know, with the pandemic and just a lot of work, particularly in the North, because there's not as many physicians that need to provide all this care to people. And so, you know, I think we have a little bit of a professional responsibility to try to eat a bit healthier and you know, sleep as well and do all those things that we tell our patients that we don't do ourselves, you know, and then so that when, you know, you get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning to go do some sutures, you're not as irritable and hopefully have a better engagement. But, you know, those are tough things, but, you know, really emphasizing the other culturally safe stuff in the past, but, we're in a very odd day with a lot of burnout and really trying to work on some physician wellness, I think needs to be a big priority as well.
So just adding on to that, taking care of ourselves so that you can dig deep into this challenging and uncomfortable, what can be uncomfortable work. So I'm wondering, what do you do or what are your favorite activities or places you like to spend in the North that help you unwind and manage your stress and your potential burnout, stay healthy?
Well, yeah, Todd and I both have kids, and I feel that kids are like almost like a mandatory wellness activity. And certainly my kids really, they call me into the present. They're an exercise in mindfulness. And I think that they, you know, certainly the joy and challenges of parenting are something that I think can really ground us and bring us back to why humans matter. I also, as far as my strategies, I say no a lot to things. So I know what my core values are. They include joy and justice. And if I'm asked to do something that doesn't correlate with those, I say no. And as physicians, we can't always do that. Obviously, we have a duty to care. And so when I'm on call, obviously, I say yes to everything. But I think that that's, you know, that's a really important thing. I don't think that my currency is not time. My currency is energy. And when I'm doing things that I'm passionate about, I can be so much more productive and impactful in what I'm doing. So that's a big ticket to wellness for me. And probably the final one would be bicycles. Incredible joy. It's basically a spiritual practice for me, I'm not going to lie.
How about yourself, Todd?
You know that mindfulness and the kids and, you know, really trying to have that. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that kind of keeps us in check to try to not work too much. And, you know, obviously we do all work too much and need to work on saying no. They've been really a good inspiration. A big thing we like to do is go for at least one big annual hunt. So we usually go hunting at the end of August. We go to the mountains and usually shoot a goat and bring the family. And so the eldest kid's been pretty in line to do that work. And, you know, he's really keen to do that work. So he'll skin it and eat everything, you know, and all the different body parts, because he doesn't want to defer or prevent us from not letting him come to the next one. So it's been really kind of neat to see that kind of aspect of that traditional background, you know, particularly with his grandfather, who has that historical knowledge. And the reason we go to Tacla so much is just they're just so culturally rich and have that background and lived experience. Has just been really neat to see. So we really try to do that. And, you know, personally try to play hockey because that keeps me in shape and have some type of goal. So, you know, we're going to do a marathon. So it kind of gets you running. You don't have to do one right now. And trying to keep in shape and do things around with the kids. So
lovely. So that is actually wrapping up our interview for this evening. So thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today. It's been so enlightening and interesting hearing about your backgrounds and the really important work that you're doing. So we will be sending you a QualityCast North mug in the near future as a small token of our gratitude for your sharing with us today. So if the listeners would like to know more about today's topics or guests, you can find more details on our show notes or on our website, which is on nhpqi.ca/podcast. And you can also find links to prior episodes. And if you enjoyed listening to today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. So thanks again for joining us. I'm Deanna Danskin.
And I'm Cher Chewy.
And this has been another episode of QualityCast North.
You've been listening to QualityCast North. Today's episode was hosted and co-produced by Dr. Cher Chewy and Deanna Danskin, with technical support from Matt Walker. Original music by Daniel Chewy and artistic support by Reggie Goodine. Further information on the content of today's episode is available with the show notes on our website, nhpqi.ca. QualityCast North is recorded on the traditional territory of the Clayclaytonay First Nation. If you enjoyed today's interview, check out our other episodes available on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you find your podcasts.